Good morning, and welcome to West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship Virtual Sunday Service. We're affectionately known as WOOF. My name is Rosie Hamilton, and I use the pronouns she and her, and it is my privilege to be your lay leader this morning. Whoever and wherever you are at this moment, we want you to know that you are welcome here. Regardless of your age or abilities, the color of your skin or where you were born, regardless of whom you love or how you identify your gender, if you do, whatever your spiritual practices may be or if you have none, we're glad that you are with us this morning. I encourage you to check the announcements in your order of service to see what else is happening this week and to join us for our virtual coffee hour at 11:30 when we check in, share joys and sorrows, and discuss the service. If this is your first time with us and you do not have an order of service, but would like to know more about us, you can get in touch with our congregational administrator at woof.org. And now, as I light the chalice, the Unitarian Universalist symbol of our shared and scattered faith, let us consider these words from A Fire in the Universe by Sharon Trapp. Our chalice reminds us of the fire within ourselves is the same fire that illuminates the universe. It is our reminder that all is connected even though the space of the void is vast, and our experience here is but a blip in the cosmic timeline. This flame is our promise that smallness and our short time on this earth, that we live intently and deeply with love for one another, with honesty and integrity, to be guided by rational thought and critical thinking, and with a sense of shared responsibility. For as the late astronomer Carl Sagan reminded us, this pale blue dot is the only home we've ever known. Let us speak together our affirmation. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful. Let us open our minds to learn what is true. Let us open our hearts to love one another.
When I Was Little, A Four-Year-Old's Memoir of Her Youth, by Jamie Lee Curtis, illustrated by Laura Cornell. When I was little, I was a baby. When I was little, I cried a lot. Now I use words.
No!
When I was little, I didn't know I was a girl. My mom told me. When I was little, I had silly hair. Now I can wear it in a ponytail, or braids, or pigtails, or a pom-pom. When I was little, I didn't get to eat Captain Crunch, or paint my toenails bubblegum pink. When I was little, I spilled a lot. My mom said I was a handful. Now I'm helpful. When I was little, I rode in a baby car seat. Now I ride like a grown-up and wave at the policeman. When I was little, I went to Mommy and Me. Now I go to nursery school, and I have teachers and cubbies and nap time and secrets. When I was little, I didn't understand time outs. Now I do, but I don't like them. When I was little, I made up words like scoop-de-loo. Now I make up songs. When I was little, I swam in the pool with boys. I still do, but now we wear bathing suits. But we don't wear floaties. When I was little, the slide at the park was so big. Now it's smaller, but I still like my granny to wait at the bottom for me. When I was little, I ate goo and yucky stuff. Now I eat pizza and noodles and fruit and Cheetos. When I was little, I had two teeth. Now I have lots, and I know how to brush them. When I was little, I slept in a zoo. Now I sleep in a big bed and get to play monkey. When I was little, I kissed my mom and dad goodnight every night. I still do, but only after they each read me a book and we play tickle torture. When I was little, I didn't know what a family was. When I was little, I didn't know what dreams were. When I was little, I didn't know who I was. Now I do. The end. Thank you for listening.
Let us enter together a few moments of silence for prayer, meditation, or reflection, as may be your tradition. I invite you to bring to mind, or speak out loud, the names of anyone that you wish to join us in our circle of caring and compassion.
Thank you. The river is flowing,
flowing and
growing.
The river is
flowing
down
to the sea.
If I Had My Life to Live Over by Nadine Stair. I'd dare to make more mistakes this time. I'd relax. I would limber up. I would be sillier than I have been this trip. I would take fewer things seriously. I would take more chances. I would climb more mountains and swim more rivers. I would eat more ice cream and less beans. I would perhaps have more actual troubles, but I'd have fewer imaginary ones. You see, I'm one of those people who live sensibly, insanely, hour after hour, day after day. Well, I've had my moments, and if I had it to do over again, I'd have more of them. In fact, I'd try to have nothing else. Just moments, one after another, instead of living so many years ahead of each day. I've been one of those persons who never goes anywhere without a thermometer, a water bottle, a raincoat, and a parachute. If I had it to do again, I would travel lighter than I have. If I had my life to live over, I would start barefoot earlier in the spring and later in the fall. I would go to more dances. I would ride more merry-go-rounds. I would pick more daisies. Today's service is The Power of Autobiography, and we're happy to host Tracy Love Silver as our speaker. Everyone has a life story to tell, but there is much more value in telling your story than meets the eye. Writing and sharing life stories helps people find new meaning in life and put life events into perspective.
There are few groups among whom you will meet as many members who are writing or planning to write their autobiography as you use. If there was ever a group who liked to express themselves or ponder moments in time or look for meaning in everyday occurrences, it's us. Life stories have value, and we know it. But the fact is that there is growing interest in life stories in the general population, and there has been for a while. Research says that there are tangible reasons for this. The foremost reason, they say, is simply because we live longer and we have more time on our hands. They also write a lot of it off to the nature of baby boomers. Previous generations, they say, were not as focused on the individual. But boomers, on the other hand, have in a lot of ways become the generation of me. I'm important. Everybody is important as an individual. What I think matters. I have a legacy, and you need to know about it. And I have wisdom that you would benefit from. But whatever the reason, sharing life stories is what all the cool kids are doing. And there are a lot of good reasons behind it. I became involved with life stories kind of by accident. I liked knowing about my grandfather growing up on the Indian reservation in the Northwest Wisconsin. I liked knowing that he was a log roller when he was a lumberjack bringing logs to market. I liked knowing the stories about how he almost died on Corregidor Island, and that he was a prison guard at Alcatraz after the military took it over. I mean, I always wished that he had written it down, as I did for my other grandparents and my parents, but that was as far as it went. I got why someone would want to write it down for posterity, but since then, I've learned that telling our stories has value way beyond that. So my real-life background is in nonprofit management and resource development, or fundraising. which on the face of it doesn't seem to be connected. I learned about fundraising from the masters at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Tell your story effectively, and donations will follow. In fact, when I was the communication specialist for the hospital, part of my job was to write founder Danny Thomas's scripts. I learned the value and the art of storytelling, but not the value of autobiography. Later, when I moved into women's rights, social services, and eventually landed in unique issues of homeless children, I began to work directly with donors and came to realize pretty rapidly that charitable giving actually has two stories that matter equally: the story of the charity and the life story of the prospective donor. I found that when you can connect those two stories, when you can find the intersection of the two stories, donors will give more, and they will give more often, and they will feel wonderful about that giving. You might even bring their heirs into the fold. I got really good at it, never feeling like I was walking around with my hand out, but rather that I was offering an opportunity for each donor to create a shared legacy with my organization and all the other people who supported it. In fact, I once went to the ladies' room during an intermission of Othello and came out with a commitment for 22 computers to outfit a computer lab for homeless kids. All because there was a line, a conversation to be had, and a couple of women eager to tell me their own stories, their own reasons for supporting education, and to share their resources to make it happen. Still, I didn't really connect it to autobiography. Then about 16 years ago, I was suffering from a major burnout from my husband. And when my husband and his partner, both certified financial planners, asked me to work for their firm, do a newsletter and some other PR type things. I thought I'd just do that long enough to get to a point where I had a second wind, and then I would jump back into social services. But while I was there, I saw this huge disconnect, and I started trying to figure it out. You know, I know that charitable giving should be integrated into a comprehensive financial plan, and certainly into an estate plan. There are tax advantages to be gained. Sometimes giving can even be deployed in a way that will actually increase the bottom line to heirs. Both of them, both my husband and his partner, were ahead of the game in simply bringing up charitable giving, because in fact, research shows that the majority of financial advisors don't. But one day I overheard a huge missed piece, a huge missed opportunity. A longtime client was finalizing her estate plan, and I heard her advisor tell her how a significant charitable gift could save considerably on her bottom line. Then, clearly because this was Memphis, Tennessee, and St. Jude dominates, within moments, the recipient was selected, and they were ready to call it a day. Now, I love St. Jude, and I happen to know that this woman was a devoted volunteer at a couple of other organizations. I knew that she headed regular clothing drives for a local domestic violence shelter. I knew she headed school supply drives for children at shelters, and I just had a feeling that no one was putting it all together, including her, because I felt certain that she would have taken great joy in knowing the difference she could make with people that she already was strongly connected to. So, to make a long story short, I struck up a conversation with her when I took a little break, put the thought into her head, and essentially threw the whole process into chaos. So I'll abbreviate what happened next, but suffice to say that Charlie, the advisor, laid it in my lap to help the client decide where her sizable gifts should go, the impact she would like to make, and on whom. So after a couple days to think it over, I decided that the best way to figure this out was simply to find out about what was important in her life, to find out about her values and where they came from. And it seemed to me that listening to her life story would be the natural place to start, and so I did. I found out that her mother had escaped an abusive relationship. I learned that she had struggled to provide for her own children and how much it meant to her when people helped her out when she needed it. I learned stuff, but it was not lost on me that she herself learned a lot she hadn't thought about, including why she felt so connected to the shelter. She wound up leaving a sizable lump of money to an educational component for shelter kids and had Charlie figure out how she could cover the cost for an outside playground for kids at the shelter while she was still alive. She was elated. Though blindsided at first, Charlie immediately understood what it meant to his client, and together we began trying to figure out why this kind of counseling wasn't just normal financial planning business. And not just for charitable giving, but for everything related to estate planning and legacy. So I started researching the industry, and I found out that there was something called values-based legacy planning, and it all revolves around a life story. I also learned that the super wealthy were all over it because, and we've all heard this, super wealth can and does destroy families. In fact, 90% of inherited wealth is lost by the third generation, largely because there's a focus on passing down valuables, but not values. Affluent families increasingly know this, and there's a growing number of organizations and professionals who design their practices to address the issue. But these professionals are there to make a comfortable living, and drawing out a life story takes time, and time is money, and a lot of it. The huge majority of us will never be in that tax bracket. So how do we benefit from the knowledge? I didn't have the answer. Well, armed with research and totally flying by the seat of my pants, I started working with clients, informally drawing out life stories to help advisors help them develop financial and estate plans that would result in a legacy they were proud of, based on values and not just valuables. And I found that the most meaningful things in someone's life aren't always visible from a surface-level conversation or from one of the big stories in their lives. For example, I remember a couple, both Holocaust survivors. They had always given large sums to Jewish organizations and to projects in Israel, as well as other social services organizations. Their giving made sense. The surface of their life story logically made these organizations ask them to contribute, and they did. But in the course of conversation, the man relayed a story about when he was a preteen in one of the camps. He said he could see the kennel where a litter of German shepherds was being raised, and he watched as they were taught to be the kind of dogs that struck terror into him and all the other prisoners. But he said that he always wished he could just get one of those puppies out of there because, he said, if someone loved just one of those puppies, there would be one less monster in the world. We talked about Michael Vick's pit bulls and how awful that situation was. Short story, although his wife would never let him have a dog because she was still terrified of them, he gave a sizable contribution to a rescue that specialized in former fighting and bait dogs. He was finally able to save the world from a monster that didn't need to exist. And he did that because he told his story and he processed what it meant to him. And this is when I finally put it together. It is all about a personal autobiography. It is about just telling the story. And I realized that I wasn't the one who really needed to hear these stories. It was their heirs, the people who loved them and would miss them when they were gone. Those stories themselves were the legacy that would endure. The money and the belongings were just incidental to a life well-lived in the eyes of people who loved him. So I started recording those conversations on a cheap audio recorder and giving them to people, to give to the people that mattered. A happy byproduct of the process. Not only that, simply telling their stories seemed to give more meaning to their own lives. They seemed to answer their own questions about their personal values and how the events in their lives shaped who they became and what they stood for. So again, to abbreviate a long, convoluted story, I started talking to a couple of estate planning attorneys about it, then pulled some fundraisers I knew into the conversation with those attorneys and realized that there was a total lack of communication between those sectors. And the next thing I knew, I was doing workshops and speaking all over the country to large groups of attorneys, advisors, and fundraisers about connecting to a person's legacy story for more engaged and fulfilled clients and donors. It seemed like something so simple, and I brought nothing to the table but common sense, but all of a sudden, autobiography was my thing. To shorten the story even more, I loved traveling when I could leave Memphis, but once I moved here, I just didn't like leaving so much, and to be honest, I really didn't like hanging out with financial planners and attorneys, so I stopped. I partnered with a cultural anthropologist friend, and because so many people had suggested it, we started doing what we called life message interviews using ethnographic interview techniques that resulted in one-hour videos that allow the viewer to really know the interviewee, how they became who they were, and where their most closely held values came from. We both loved the interview process, but the technology hurt our heads and we didn't want to move to the price point that would allow us to hire the tech help we needed. So neither of us enjoyed selling either, so we kind of let that fizzle when we found something called GAB, Guided Autobiography, and we finally felt like we didn't have to reinvent the wheel. This was a process that was accessible to everyone and proven to provide the many and diverse benefits of life review and life stories. World-renowned gerontologist Dr. James Bierman created GAB in the mid-1970s while he was the founding dean of Davis School of Gerontology at the University of Southern California. Over the next 40 years, he carefully fine-tuned its techniques to optimize the positive impacts on the people who participated in the GAB workshops. Today, GAB instructors include social workers, nurses, psychologists, educators, clergy, hospice staff, and a lot of other fields. GAB is not rocket science. It is a method for helping people document their life stories. Guided by a trained instructor, small groups are led through activities and priming questions that draw out particularly meaningful memories that have very often been filed away from consciousness. Participants write two pages on a specific theme and then share them with the group at the next week's session. It's not really autobiography in the truest sense of the word. The result is not a chronological telling of a life story. GAB product is actually memoir in that it relates life events and their effect on the storyteller's life, beliefs, and values, the good stuff. GAB essays shed light on who the storyteller is to anyone who will read it in the future, but just as importantly, to the writers themselves. The Bierman Center has 40 years of research that demonstrates that telling your story in this way can be a powerful catalyst for improved self-esteem, self-confidence, and communication within communities and within families, and that it can help put these life events and their consequences into perspective. And I'll add, those workshops can be a lot of fun. So leaving out the science and the research, one of the most important things that GAB process handles is, in my opinion, our limited attention spans. It allows life stories to emerge in bite-sized pieces, each self-contained and meaningful on its own, or as one of many stories that form a collage that defines a life. Sitting down to write a life story is a huge daunting task. Sitting down to write 2 pages on a specific event or theme feels infinitely more doable, no matter how many times you do it. There are a lot of resources out there to help you get started. The GAB method is just the one I like the best. There are some tools from GAB that you can use individually, but getting started in a GAB group is a great way to kick it off. You can do that online, or if there's enough interest, we could run a 6-week workshop here at WOOF as an option item, as we've done twice before. So I have a lot of experience with life stories and how telling them can impact us in profound ways. Not because I have any credentials on the subject, but merely because I've seen it firsthand in a lot of different areas. I felt it firsthand, and the way it can change our entire way of being, and how it can give additional meaning to our lives in terms of the way we invest our time and our talents. There are a lot of right ways to do it, but whether you do it like a dog with a bone in one long fell swoop, or whether you do it little by little in bite-sized portions. What I also know is that the most important part of the process is just to do it. And don't worry about how well you write, your subject verb agreement, or your masterful use of imagery. It's the story itself that's important. Tell it for posterity. Tell it for legacy. Tell it for self-actualization. Tell it for catharsis. Tell it for fun. But just tell it.
This is a time in our service when we pause to reflect on the gifts we have received from this abundant earth and the generous spirit of family and community, to consider what it is that we have that given and what it is that we are grateful for. Please join me in our affirmation of gratitude and giving. Let us be grateful when we are able to give, for many do not have this privilege. Let us be grateful for all those who share their gifts with us, for we are enriched by their giving. And let us be grateful even for our needs, so that we may learn from the generosity of others. As we extinguish the chalice, let us carry with us the warm glow of its flame and the values of Unitarian Universalism.